This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's that time of the month again where I catch up with Wong Siew Lin and Lau Yau Hua, the founders of Makaranga. So today we're going to be speaking about the illegal smuggling of rhino horns in South Africa. A Malaysian was involved. And then there is African swine fever over in Sabah. What's happening over there? And two species of white-handed gibbons instead of one. What is happening? We're going to find out more. And also, of course, we're going to see how the Johor elections, whether there's any sort of environmental manifesto being discussed at all. Welcome, both of you. How are you today?
Fine, thank
good,
you.
Good, busy. Yeah, but good. We always say we are busy.
Well, I've been watching you guys. You know, there's been so many articles coming out on Makaranga this month alone, so I can imagine there must be a lot of stress going on there. But let's start talking about some of the big news from this month. So I think earlier this month, there were reports that a 40-year-old suspect was apprehended for rhino horn smuggling at Johannesburg's International Airport. And I think he was on board Qatar Airways flight to Malaysia. Am I correct? Tell me what happened.
Basically, at the check-in counter, he was caught before he even got on the plane. Basically, the airport personnel in South Africa, they noticed something suspicious in the bag and then quickly called in the authorities, and this guy was nabbed. And unfortunately, he was Malaysian. The horns were hidden in candies and green tea boxes. So anyway, this is unfortunately the seventh rhino horn seizure linking South Africa and Malaysia since 2020. This is according to Traffic, yeah? The Traffic, the NGO that's working on global trade in wild animals and plants, yeah? Mm-hmm. So not so good, but, you know, so that's one piece of news. You know, people have to be alert. Authorities have to be alert. And one of the things that Traffic is doing is working with Post Malaysia here in Malaysia to make sure that the authorities know how to detect any kind of, you know, strange, funny packages in people's luggage, and in Post Malaysia's case, in any of the parcels that come through. So again, unfortunately, between 2008 and 2021, Traffic reported that there were 3,100 wildlife parts and products that were seized. So we don't know how many had made it through, but this is how many parts and including whole wildlife that was seized, right? So they've been working with Post Malaysia in what they call the international hub at KLIA, the Kuala Lumpur International Airport, which is a very critical logistics hub, right? And they've trained 40 Post Malaysia staff, auxiliary police, customs officers, and all these folks are involved in screening parcels and mail for so-called dangerous and prohibited goods, right? So they came, they attended courses, they were shown how to, you know, like sort of identify what's in x-rays, how traffickers ship, how they conceal this, you know. So I guess green tea and candies would be something to look out for, right? But it's also very interesting what the way Traffic did the training. They also used an exhibition and quizzes. So they got everybody involved, not just these 40, I believe so, right? Following this training, they're going to roll out a suite of awareness materials. This is all according to Traffic materials, including like posters, banners, videos, infographics, all targeting everyone who's working at this international hub. So hopefully, and also, yes, that's right. There's also a guidebook which features x-ray images of commonly trafficked wildlife parts so that people know what to look out for.
Okay, I think that's really important training, right? Especially now with, you know, all of us ordering things online, right? Really, really important, yeah.
No, it's good that they're training, right? Yeah. Training them and having them look out for, you know, all these signs, because it's like almost every month or every 2 months that we hear or read in the news that Malaysia is again, you know, involved in all this like illegal trafficking and smuggling. And so, yeah, this is all good efforts here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in any conversation that I've had with traffic also, you know, they just say that smugglers always find ways to outwit the authorities, isn't it? So it's wonderful that, you know, this effort is being put to train the authorities about, you know, new different methods that smugglers are using.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, just moving on to another issue, which you guys brought up as well, you know, in our previous conversation, African swine fever in Sabah, you know, that's devastated wild pig numbers, I think, since February last year. So it's a year already, right? And I know Makaranga has released two articles related to this. What is it that we should know about this situation?
Well, basically, the data is really hard to get. We struggled. So Kimberly Chu, who is the author here, and her partner, the field reporter and photographer in Sabah, Alvin Chung, really tried to get hold of data, talk to all sorts of different people to try and understand exactly what's going on. Because if you look at the official data, which actually the Sabah Department of Veterinary Services were very cautious about sharing, and in fact, we had to get the data from an international public website, which is the World Organization for Animal Health, which the Sabah DVS actually reports to. So what they call the short form is OIE. What OIE does is it collects all the sort of data from all over the world and put it up for public consumption. So they've got also maps and all sorts of different ways of showing the data, right? And that came from the Malaysian Vet Department, right? And that data actually does not reflect at all, when we looked at it, does not reflect at all the severity of the problem. So what we had been hearing, the news reports have been saying right from the get-go in January last year, is that it is devastating pigs everywhere, wild pigs everywhere, right? And then there were reports of it infecting what they call backyard pigs. And these are like so-called babi kampung, which the local indigenous communities, actually, Kadazan Dusun Murut, they keep in their backyards, right? And so those were getting affected as well. And then the commercial pig farms. But if you look at the data, actually, that was one of the things that, you know, we struggled with in the story. It was like the data reveals so little, so few pigs, you know, that have been culled or affected by ASF, African swine fever. And then in reality, there's this, like, you know, there's no more pigs. We tried to send a photographer out. So Elvin tried to look for people who could take him to go and look for pigs. And there were no pigs anywhere. There were no wild pigs anywhere.
Gosh.
It was impossible to take any photos of wild pigs, you know. So we had to work with, thank goodness for really nice researchers who had been doing camera trapping. So they sent us their photos and we were able to use that. So roughly, it's anecdotal, basically what's happening. And it's because data is so hard to get. And it's because to detect an outbreak is really not easy. There are several steps that need to be followed, you know, especially if it's spread out all over an area. And you know, Sabah is not a small state. It's quite a large state. And the pigs as well, the male pigs are actually solitary animals outside of mating season. So female pigs and the piglets, you can actually detect. They might go in groups, right? And of course, in mating seasons, then you can get like large groups. But otherwise, if they're spread out and you're walking through the forest and then you see one dead wild pig there, you're not going to think anything of it. You might think, okay, that's natural,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But then, you know, more and more and more of this was starting to come out. So the Wildlife Department went in, the Sabah Veterinary Services went in, and then, so you have to detect it, and then you have to find enough cases to ensure that it's actually an outbreak, right? You have to look at the size of the findings, you have to look at the timing, the severity, and then try and generate a hypothesis of the likely sources, right? And then you've got to test the hypothesis. Then you've got to try and figure out and solve the point of contamination, how did it spread? And then when you can come to the control stage. So it's not an easy thing to do. And of course, what was going on at the same time last year? COVID. And the MCO. So you know, all this kind of worked against being able to get good data. And our story was to use the data to try and tell a story about the impact of African swine fever in Sabah. And basically, it's generally anecdotal that it's bad. So we spoke to hunters, traditional hunters. Wild pigs are very important to them. We spoke to researchers and you know, their use of camera traps. And we also spoke to farmers, the backyard farmers, like how does it impact the local Kadazan Dusun communities? And basically, it's banned. And now what you have is African swine fever in Sarawak, where there's been tons of culling. So one of the ways of controlling it is to cull pigs, right?
Yeah.
Tons of commercial pigs have been culled. And it's also here in Peninsula Malaysia. And there's culling going on in Malaysia as well, and Peninsula Malaysia as well. So, you know, it's very interesting to detect an outbreak, to find out the severity, to understand the impact, and then to put controls in. It's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, and you know, data is at the heart of all of this, right? And then all the possible ecological impact, if the babi hutan are decimated, and if the bearded pigs are decimated, then of course it, you know, the thing is, I think all the species of pigs and swine are susceptible to African swine fever, right? And so, No matter how hard is it to get the data, I mean, it's still questionable whether it's we don't get the data because the data is tough to get or it's just not being shared. I think the less the data that comes out, then the more worried people would get. And that's not good for everyone. Mm-hmm. So highly, you know, encourage the data to be shared. Yeah.
Something that I think the government's very concerned about is to make sure that people understand the disease doesn't pass from pigs to humans. It doesn't, right?
It doesn't, yeah.
So it's actually safe to consume if you cook it thoroughly. You know, unfortunately, it spreads so quickly amongst pigs that they are encouraging people not to eat wild boar or wild pigs, you know. And then the control of exports or movement of these pigs across borders, even within districts, and stuff like that, they're trying to contain it that way.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, what I'm hearing from you guys is we just need some transparency in terms of the data that is available, right?
Yes, but, you know, although Sabah DVS could not send us the data, they did publish it on a public site. So it was actually available from there, you know.
Okay.
So it is actually being shared. But what I went through just now is it's not easy to confirm. You can't just look at a bunch of pigs and say, okay, right, ASF got them. You know, it's not, you can't just point your finger and say, oh, okay, it's got like reddish marks on its belly, and I was talking to Yahua about this on its ears as well, right? The reddish marks. It's not so easy to just point your finger and say, okay, so this is ASF, and they've all died of ASF, you know, that sort of thing. So it's tricky.
Okay. All right. I guess just to move on to something which maybe was a little cheerier. I mean, a local study on white-handed gibbons in the country may have led to the discovery of a distinct subspecies. Am I correct? So that may have evolved in isolation. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if this is more joyous. I mean, it's a very scientific finding, but it does give us a bit more concern about our conservation efforts of the white-handed gibbon. So, you know, in Peninsular Malaysia, there are two species of this gibbons of this genus. So the white-handed gibbon and the black-handed gibbon. The white-handed gibbon have always, you know, in Peninsular Malaysia, have always been thought to be the same subspecies as the one that range from, you know, Johor all the way to Thailand, right? Mm-hmm. But in a routine genetic analysis, the researchers from Pahilitan, from University of Malaysia Sarawak, you know, UKM and UPM, you know, what they found was that the population of white-handed gibbons south of Kedah in Peninsular Malaysia, you know, south of the Muda, south of Kedah, it appears that they could be a different subspecies than the ones in northern Kedah and all the way to Thailand.
Okay.
So what that means is, you know, in Malaysia, instead of one species of white-handed gibbons, there could actually be two subspecies of white-handed gibbons. You know, the research is based on, you know, analyzing a small part of the genome of just 12 captive white-handed gibbons. So, you know, the researchers are saying that it's not, you know, really like confirmed, you know, you need to study more samples and analyze a larger part of the genome. But if this holds true, then it would mean that we got to be a bit more cautious on how we conserve our white-handed gibbons, because now all the ones in the south are actually a different subspecies, right? So it's not like, you know, 1,000 individuals of one species, but rather two subspecies, and each has a smaller number. So then it makes it more important that we conserve them in the wild and also in captivity. Yeah.
Okay. All right, so not really the good news I thought it was, but okay.
Well, it's good news that they found it, right?
That's
good news that they found it, yeah.
That's true. Okay, all right.
It's always excellent when we find new animals or we discover that, you know, there's something new that's happening, that's the wonder. And that's, again, another reason that for conservation, you know, you know there's so many things that something that you think is one thing is actually another thing, you know, or could be another thing, you know, and that's marvelous.
Yeah, like the orangutans in the Tapanuli orangutans, right? I mean, that was like a huge, wow, that was wonderful. Okay, before we quickly wrap up, just looking forward, I guess, you know, the big news, locally anyway, of course, is the Johor state elections. Any of you seen any sort of election manifesto that's, you know, covering anything to do with the environment? I found nothing.
Yeah, so far, nothing, right? And, you know, the candidates the nomination day was like 2 days ago. And so we now know who the candidates are, you know, for all the 56 seats in the Johor Adun. And, you know, they're going to the ballot on the 12th of March, you know, so very quickly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, the thing is, so far we have been hearing about, you know, or maybe creating jobs, which party is, you know, which candidate is from which party, and that also it's mostly political agenda. But, you know, Johor has serious environmental concerns, right? Some of the most polluted rivers are in Johor. So, you know, I'm really hoping that the candidates for those constituencies that have huge river pollution problems, like, you know, the ones in Permas, Johor, Jaya, that's Sungai Kim Kim, you know, should really be looking at this, right? Mm. At least come up with a manifesto so that we can, you know, the voters can actually put the candidates to a test, sort of, you know, hold them to their promises, right? If they don't deliver it or if they do deliver it. Yeah, and then there's also, you know, forests, right? You know, Johor has some of the lowest levels of permanent reserve forest area. Only 17% of Johor is Hutan Simpan Kekal. Mm. There's another additional 4% that has been approved by the state government for years, but not actually gazetted. So it would be great. Like for me, I was like, oh, if anyone can promise that they will gazette it, like, you know, within a year of them taking office, oh, that person will take my vote. But I'm not Johorian anyway. So yeah. And then another thing that I would like to, like, you know, really highlight is that I've spoken to the state director of the Johor Department of Environment, and he has told me that they really like to do a lot more monitoring, you know, for example, the pollution and whether, you know, forestry projects are carried out as expected. But they are so short of staff. That's also part of an environmental agenda for me, you know, a manifesto to really empower and to give these departments, you know, the necessary resources to do their work well.
Yeah. Guess, you know, we'll wait and see. I mean, everybody, it's really quite there's a mini war going on in Johor. But let's hope, you know, these really important things that will come to affect the people and Johor itself, you know, are taken into consideration. But my thanks to the both of you, you know, always so informative and so much to explore. Wong Siew Lin and Lau Ya Hua, founders of Makaranga, giving us a wrap up of, you know, some big environmental news from February 2022. If you have the time, go head to makaranga.org to read all their articles there. There's so much there as well. And if you miss any part of today's interview, just download the podcast at bfm.my/earth, or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.